This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. What are you planting in the garden this summer? It might be time to start thinking about extending your summer crops into the fall. Today on our gardening show, we'll ask our experts about getting more out of your growing season with proper plant protection. We'll also talk about what's up with oak wilt and discuss whether your trees are susceptible. And we'll talk about some natural solutions for the pest problems in your yard. Joining me now are Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator, Joe Boggs. Welcome back, Joe.
Oh, it's nice to be back.
Always great to have you. Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator, Kamisha Montgomery. Thanks for being here, Kamisha.
Thank you, Lucy. It's great to be here.
Great to have you. And Madison Tree Care and Landscaping Vice President and CEO, John Butcher. Welcome back, John.
Hey, Lucy.
Hey. Hey, John. We know you have questions for our gardening experts, so give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Kamisha, let's start with you. What should we be planting this month? Can we be planting new stuff right now?
Definitely. Now is not the end of the gardening season. There's things that you can plant now and also towards the end of July that will lead you into a great harvest before the first frost. But then you can also start to think about what to grow later on in the season, in that fall season, where everyone sort of puts the garden to bed. It's also an opportunity to continue to grow.
So what should we be planting if we're eager to plant new stuff right now? What should it be?
Well, you can plant determinate varieties of tomatoes. You can plant bush beans. You can plant carrots. It all depends on the varieties because you have to remember how many days that you have left. So you just need to make sure that you don't have plants that take up way more days than what we have left available to grow.
It's all about reading those packages, right?
Definitely, the maturity.
Yeah. What should we be harvesting right now?
Oh, there's a chard is a good one to harvest. Cucumbers are available right now. You can also harvest green tomatoes right now. I've been out to a few gardens recently and I haven't seen as many mature red tomatoes, but there's a lot of green tomatoes that you can harvest right now. You can harvest your onions and some of your kale and other brassicas to try to make room in your garden for others like succession planting.
Well, and you talked a little bit about kind of the best ways to extend that growing season into the fall. What are your best tips for that?
Well, like I said, just trying to make sure that you're getting things in the ground before that first frost and knowing how many days you have left. Right now, the first frost is estimated to be in October, early October. So you have roughly about 100 days left of growing season. But you can start putting in, starting seeds indoors, like for your kale, your collards. But you also can put down and sow directly carrots, beets, other root crops. And also, you know, just starting to think about what you need to protect those crops when the frost comes, like a cold frame or row cover.
Well, and with these hot temperatures we're having month after month after month, is that kind of naturally extending our growing season?
Naturally, yes. And that's what people need to take appreciation over. Is taking that opportunity to grow even earlier in the year and then later in the year.
Okay. We're talking about gardening for the full hour today. We have experts here to answer your questions. Don't wait till the end. Give us a call right now at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. John, let's talk oat wilt. What the heck is it?
Oak wilt is a disease that's very devastating to oak trees. It's been a lot of other places in the country where it's wiped out native populations of oak. In Cincinnati, it's really never taken traction, but we found positive cases here. And so we're really taking extra precautions to make sure that we're doing whatever we can so that it doesn't spread. It is the most likely way it would spread to a regular homeowner's tree would be something called a picnic beetle, which is a sap-eating beetle that eats the sap of an infected tree and then flies over and would eat the sap of an uninfected tree. Most likely, a new pruning cut would be the reason that that would come about. And so we're trying to shift most of our oak tree pruning of live branches to the dormant season to minimize that risk. There's other things that can be done, lots more to be said about this. Joe, I'm sure, has a ton to say about it, but it's a really big deal, and we're hoping that it doesn't really take hold in Cincinnati. But right now, it looks like no panic button should be pressed, and we just need to monitor. We need to send away samples to be tested when we have trees in question. We need to pay attention, but we don't need to freak out and treat every tree, but we need to use good horticulture and just keep our eyes out.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned Joe. He's our bug guy with these beetles. Does that mean this is Joe's fault?
It is Joe's fault, okay. Actually.
Yeah, that's it. Yes, I just control them all.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the beetles are important. Yeah, they're an important point, though, because unlike something like emerald ash borer that goes to a specific host, the sap beetles or, you know, subgroup picnic beetles, they'll go to any sap on any tree. Like, for example, if you had a maple tree that has kind of a bleeding wound, those sap beetles will go there as well. So if they fly from an infected tree, the fungus actually produces a fruiting structure that smells good to these beetles. That's how they draw them in. But if those beetles left that tree and flew past or flew, you know, near a maple that's weeping sap, they'll stop there. So that's kind of good news. But I want to emphasize something that John said, because this harkens back to when last season we had some challenges with boxwoods, and John did a very nice job of sending 10 samples of boxwoods to really nail down just how prevalent Volutella is on boxwoods. Well, he's doing the same thing, looking to do the same thing with oak wilt, because there are a lot of things that can make oak trees not look good. But if someone is believing it's oak wilt, it's essential. It is just essential to get it confirmed by a clinic. And I have to applaud John's efforts. He did that last year. And this is what we love to see our professionals do, is to follow up with confirmations. And so I think probably, John, it's just stay tuned, right?
Yeah, stay tuned. And in positive news, almost actually in the last 2 years, I haven't gotten a positive test back personally. So there's not been a lot of positive cases, which is good.
So what do you look for if you think if your oak tree is not looking happy? I mean, what are the signs that it could be oak wilt, and how do you know if it's something else instead?
Well, I mean, testing is the only way to really know, but you're looking for the top of the tree to start dying back, I think is what I've seen in the couple positive cases that I've encountered. Joe may have a little more info on that, but it's general dieback of the crown, and then without a test, there's just no way to know.
But it's important to get that test, because if it's oak wilt, it could spread rapidly, right?
Yeah, so there's the beetle that can spread it like over longer distances from tree to tree, but trees that are connected by roots below the surface have those will spread freely from one tree to the other if it gets it. So if one has it and you've got multiple oak trees on your property or neighbor's property, it'd be really important to find that out to develop a proper care plan to move forward.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We have a caller on the line. Hi, Stephen. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi, Lucy. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good. Pretty good, but itchy.
Oh, no.
Every summer, we get chiggers so badly, and I'm the only one that gets them. I take medication for an autoimmune disorder, and it just, every summer, it gets worse and worse. I look like I have the pox. Is there anything we can use on our lawn and our gardens and our beds that would be safe for our dogs but get the chiggers? My wife tries things like Wonderside, and that does absolutely nothing. Mm. So that is my question.
Okay. So you're just too sweet for your own good, it sounds like, Stephen. Joe, do you have thoughts on this?
Well, we have to start with what chiggers are and the environmental conditions that really support them. They are little mites, M-I-T-E-S, so they're little mites. They don't do well if it's extremely dry. So let's put those two things together. So in landscaping, what we like to see is landscaping that is kept cut back from where you're going to have contact. If you can, open it up a bit through pruning to keep things dry. One of the most important things to do now is to consistently mow that lawn. Once again, you know, chiggers don't do well where it's dry. This also actually applies to a lot of our tick species too, which is which they're actually closely related. So keeping the lawn mowed, keeping the brush back, keeping things from getting overgrown, extremely important. However, there can be occurrences, and we still don't quite understand the biology involved with this, but occasionally we will have hot spots. Now, it surprises me, these hot spots typically don't last year after year, but in a lawn, we'll have an area where, you know, the chiggers can build populations very rapidly. And again, we don't understand why. In that particular case, though, it may be important, and I would recommend actually seeking the help of a professional to make an application of an insecticide. And you say, well, what's the impact on the pets? Once again, we always tell people, no matter what you're spraying, read and follow those label directions. What the professional will tell you is keep your pets inside until the product has dried. That's a general rule of thumb. Sometimes they'll say, you know, wait a day, again, if that's on the label. But then the mammalian toxicity is very low for these compounds. And it is, at some point, just about the only option if you do have hot spots.
Hmm. Stephen, have you tried pesticides? Have you tried spraying anything in the past?
I have not tried anything that was not completely safe, you know, for the pets. But I'm getting desperate. I may have to use something that's a little higher toxicity and just keep the dogs off of it for like a day.
Yeah.
And if that fails, I am considering a flamethrower. Bushes, plants, grass, gone.
Yeah. Maybe, you know, just green concrete would look good in your yard.
AstroTurf.
Yeah.
Well, we've tried everything. I mean, the grass is super short. There's nothing, you know, around the fence. It's just so aggravating.
Oh, well, Stephen, I'm sorry you're having that trouble. I hope you can get some relief. Thanks so much for calling. We appreciate it. We are talking about gardening for the full hour today. We have experts here. They are ready to answer your questions. Give us a call at 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. Okay, we did get an email from... who is it from? It is from Joy. And Joy wrote, "Help! I put grass clippings in my compost and then put it on my asparagus bed. Nothing came up this spring, including the normal volunteer tomatoes. I do have my lawn treated in the spring for weeds, so I'm afraid I have contaminated my compost and my asparagus bed. Should I try to remove the top layer of soil? Will I be able to eat my asparagus next year? Thanks." I'm going to toss that one to you, Kamisha. What do you think?
I think that may have been the culprit. You can remove a few inches of your soil and adding compost. But definitely, you know, if you're having some issues, I wouldn't recommend that you use treated grass in your compost for situations such as this. But I would, you know, definitely recommend taking back at least about an inch or two of your soil and putting in some compost and wish the best.
Okay, keep those fingers crossed. We have an email from Sharon. "This is the first year my pawpaw trees produced fruit. One day I went out to check on them and every single fruit was gone. There had to be at least 50 fruit per tree. It appears that squirrels ate them. Any ideas for deterring squirrels from eating the fruit off the trees?" John, do you have thoughts about squirrels?
Well, it could be squirrels. It might be raccoons. There are certainly lots of critters excited for that pawpaw fruit. And like most fruit in the garden, if you want it reliably, a lot of times you have to pick it a little bit early and set it on the counter and let it ripen there, because this happens. I mean, it happens with a lot of fruit crops. It happens with apples, peaches, anything that you really care about. So other than like putting some kind of fence mechanism around it, which would be extremely difficult to do, or some other means of controlling squirrels, of which I would not condone, I just don't know, other than picking early, what you can really do there.
Yeah, That sounds like good advice. They must be really good pawpaws. I mean, that's the good news, I guess.
It seems early. Yeah. Like, I can't imagine they're even ripe yet.
Yeah.
No, they're
when they're
not
falling on the ground is the sign that they're ready. So right now, I think those raccoons are jumping the gun a little bit. Mm. So
maybe they're letting them ripen on their kitchen raccoon counters.
Yeah, that's. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. It does seem early. I have to say, I have a little pawpaw tree in my backyard, and it is producing fruit. At first, what I thought she was going to say was, you know, you start out with all these blooms, and then if you look, the early developing fruit looks like banana bunches. That's exactly, I mean, I've shown the pictures, they just look like bunches of bananas. Hmm. And at that point, you think, oh, my goodness, I'm going to have pawpaws all over the place. But then this tree starts self-excising them, and it depends on how many leaves per fruit. And there's actually some good research showing fairly accurate ratios. There have to be so many leaves through photosynthesis that will support so many fruits. Same thing happens with a lot of other fruit trees. Hmm. So you'll start seeing pawpaws that are dropping very tiny because the tree gets down to the number of fruit that it can support. And at first, I thought that was going to be the question because, you know, my pawpaws are probably not more than about 2 inches long, if that long, and way, way early. And I can't even imagine that they have any pulp to speak of. So these squirrels... Yeah, it just sounds like they're really getting desperate for something. I don't know.
Really determined.
I've never heard of that.
We do have a caller on the line. Excuse me. Hey, Anna Dean, what's your question?
Hi there. I love the show, by the way. Just want to say that I listen as often as I can, and I just love how much advice and info you guys give, so thank you for that. But I was also wondering if you could give me some insight on diatomaceous earth, because I got it for my potted plants for fungus gnats, but I also heard that it was good for keeping pests, such as chiggers, because that's something that I also have a real problem with in my yard, and I've just never used it before. I'm just, like, wondering what you guys have to say about it.
I'm going to toss that one to you, Joe. What do you think?
Well, that's really interesting. Diatomaceous earth, just for, you know, listeners thinking, what are we talking about here? It comes from a type of organism called a diatom, which are single-celled organisms. And what's really interesting is that they wrap themselves in a silicon that is actually glass. And it's very interesting because, you know, you can look at these under a microscope. They're beautiful little creatures and live in glass houses, so they don't throw any rocks at each other. I'm sorry,
oh,
I had
Joe,
to get that in there. Oh,
Joe,
that was
Joe.
Bad. Okay, you can mute me now. But the diatomaceous earth that we use for pest control is our diatoms that, you know, fell to the ocean floor millions of years ago. And so we see these high concentrations. Now, two things that you need to be real careful about. Make sure, anybody listening, make sure you are using diatomaceous earth that is labeled for use for pest management. Because the diatomaceous earth that's also maybe used in pool filters has very rough edges. Those glass particles are not made to be used outside around where people can possibly inhale them. So that's just something I want to make sure everybody's aware of. Okay, use the right type, you know, that doesn't present a hazard to people. Now, in terms of their use, yes, they can be highly effective, but here's how they work. The insect, or in the case of chiggers, the mites, so arthropods in general, they're wrapped in a exoskeleton that helps them to maintain water so they don't dehydrate. Now, if you scratch that exoskeleton, and actually you're scratching through the waxy surface first and then down into some of the layers beneath, that then can be a place where moisture is lost. So two things to keep in mind. The insect has to come in direct contact with it. It has to crawl through it. It doesn't kill by them eating it. But if we have heavy rains like we just had and you put down diatomaceous earth, think about where it's going to go. And this happens quite a lot when we try to manage insects that are further, you know, for example, chiggers. Now, chiggers aren't going to be just crawling around in the soil. They're going to be up on plants. And so if you make this application, it could be that they are not going to contact the diatomaceous earth and you won't get a good result if it's rained off or if you've done something that's removed it from the target. So those are all the things just to keep in mind. It's not 100% effective all the time. A lot of times people will use it and think, oh, that's the end of that. It's also labeled for use indoors, for example. Some companies use it with cockroach management. But once again, you have to understand what it is and how it works so you can maximize the effectiveness of the use of diatomaceous earth.
Anna Dean, I sure hope that helps. Thank you so much.
It helps a lot.
Oh, good.
Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for calling. We're going to have to take a quick break. We'll be back with more of our gardening show in just a few minutes. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our gardening show, and our experts are here to answer your questions. My guests are Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs, Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator Kamisha Montgomery, and Madison Tree Care and Landscaping Vice President and CEO John Butcher. We know you have questions, so give us a call at 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We have Jeremy on the line. Thanks for your patience, Jeremy. What's your question?
So I want to turn my yard into my own personal nature sanctuary. So I'm thinking, like, you know, natural fence lines. And, you know, really my question is what kind of resources are out there to help me decide which plants and shrubs and trees will thrive and grow best in our area?
Great question. John, I'm going to toss that to you.
Well, certainly there are lots of horticulture and landscape professionals like myself that can help you develop a plan like that. And I'm sure that Joe could tell us about something on the extension side of things that you can probably research on the internet pretty easily to get a good start.
Yeah. Joe, do you have tips?
Well, really what you're talking about is a landscape design. So let's start there. And thankfully, there's a lot of information, not just from Extension, but also from, you know, the professional horticulture community on naturalized areas. And that may be a key word you want to use, naturalized areas. A lot of people say or think, you know, it's interchangeable with native plants, and that's not entirely true. Because there are some non-natives that do quite well here and can fit into that naturalized area. I think that's how I would approach this. I do want to go back, though, with what John said. I hear you're wanting to do it yourself, and that's fantastic. But if you really run up against a challenge, it's just not a bad idea to get in touch with one of our many, many outstanding professionals in the area, John, for example, and others, who do have experience in, for example, what kind of trees do well here. And that way, you might spend a little money and get a lot more out of the result than if you're casting about on your own. Now, I'm not saying don't do that because you're going to learn a lot, and that's always fantastic. But to kind of make sure that you're going down the right track, a lot of companies will help you with a design, help, you know, provide input on things that may or may not work. And then you do the installation and all the other parts of it. Some will do the whole thing. One thing I would caution, though, don't bite off a big piece at a time. That seems to me, I think, John, I know you're shaking your head. You had, and Kamisha, you probably are too. Because how many times have we run across, you know, well-intended, a fantastic, we want to do this on our whole landscaping. And in about a two-year period, people are just exhausted. So take a small section and focus on that, then take another section and focus on that. And that way you're more likely to have a positive outcome, but also a better experience.
I hope that helps, Jeremy. Thank you so much. And best of luck with your project. Thank you. We got an email from Rebecca, and she writes, "Hi, I have two tomato plants in one large pot. When it's hot and dry, I need to water them up to 3 times a day to avoid wilting. I'm afraid I'm overwatering as I'm getting a lot of leaves yellowing at the bottom of the plant, and I don't want the roots to start rotting. How much water do potted tomatoes need, and is wilting okay?" Kamisha, what do you think?
Well, with the heat, you might see some wilting. It depends on the material of the pot also. Hopefully that you have some holes at the bottom of the pot where it's just not holding water at the roots. But having two, it depends, you know, if there's a determinate and indeterminate variety of tomatoes, hopefully they're one or the other and not two separate varieties in that one pot, because one might need more attention as far as trellising and things of that nature. But as far as watering, you might see some leaves, you know, with this heat that we just had, and we just had a conversation on June having less rain that we've had in quite some time. So, you know, watering and watering deeply is suggested, especially for a container garden.
But a little wilting is kind of normal, isn't it, when it's real hot out?
Yeah, definitely.
Mm-hmm. I would make, without being an agriculturalist, if you will, if your tomato needs water three times a day, probably need a bigger pot. Usually once a day will cover it if you've got enough soil volume, is my personal experience.
Okay.
Well, and there's another point here, and this has to do with fertilizer. You know, Lucy, I know you're going to start laughing, but I'm going to talk about, you know, the yellowing of the leaves may be also coming because as you're watering a lot, whatever nutrients are in that soil, and I'm assuming soilless media, our potting soil actually can't hold on to nutrients very well. And we buy potting soil, it will have sometimes on the bag, you know, that it does contain, you know, various minerals and nutrients, you know, fertilizers. However, over time, particularly with nitrogen, you can easily leach that through. In fact, if you have house plants and they're starting to develop what we call salt deposits, that white material, the recommendation is to take them into a sink, you know, and run water through them so you can pull out all of those mineral salts, which just happen to sometimes be the same nutrients that you'd like to have for the plant. So I think that you also want to pay attention to perhaps you know, buying some very slow release form of fertilizer labeled for the use of tomatoes, because that yellowing could also be associated with lack of nutrients. And then also you may have less tomato production because of that. Does that sound about right, Commissioner?
Yeah, definitely. Fertilizing is something that you should do with tomatoes. And like you said, making sure that the fertilizer is specific for tomatoes. There's a lot of different varieties out there that you can choose from.
We got an email from Joshua with a question for Joe. I have a weeping cherry that every year is beset by Japanese beetles. I have tried neem oil by the gallon and a product from Bayer in a blue container that claims 12 months of protection against them. Nothing seems to keep them away, and my tree gets nearly destroyed every year. Joe, do you have advice for Joshua?
Wow, that is really interesting, because we are seeing higher populations of Japanese beetles this year than we've seen in quite some time. They're starting to behave now like native insects. So we have, you know, rise and fall of populations. It is a surprise to have this happen every year, to be honest. I mean, John, do you see that year after year in locations and, you know, with the trees you're working with?
Yeah, they keep coming back to the same spot in a lot of cases. Not all, but certainly I have clients that I always tell them, like, hey, it'll be better next year. And they're right back on the same exact plant they were the year before. So
you're lying to your clients? Is that what you're saying, John?
not intentionally.
I didn't mean to turn this into a political interview, but we can go there if we need to go there. No, it's just they're like goodness. Tricky little guys. They come back even when you don't expect them to. Is that what you're saying?
That's correct.
Okay. Sorry, John.
Well, So we drove into the ditch there for a second, didn't we?
Sorry. Getting back on the rails.
Back on the road.
John, what would you like to say?
Joe's fault again.
I'm importing them. Well, a couple of things you don't want to do. Let's first say just right out of the chute, because people are having more Japanese beetles this year than in previous years in general. Which is, like I said, a bit of a surprise. Do not buy a Japanese beetle trap unless you put them way far down the road, because those traps attract both males and females. And so you'll just get a higher number of Japanese beetles to that source, or whatever that might be. The other point is that if you can do something early, Japanese beetles tend to do this. Once they find a food supply, you know, they communicate chemically like a lot of insects, and there are different types of what we call pheromones. If it's a pheromone for mating, that's called a sex pheromone. If it's a pheromone for come and eat. That is an aggregation pheromone. And it turns out Japanese beetles have a very effective aggregation pheromone. Some entomologists call it the party pheromone because it pulls all these Japanese beetles into one location. What happens, though, is that you then want to concentrate on the first ones arriving. We call those the scouts. So if you do something, you know, relative to pulling in or getting rid of those early scouts, then you can do a lot towards managing Japanese beetles. And I'm going to tell you what I do for my weeping cherry. I put out a bird feeder. And you're probably thinking, wait a second, why would I? The bird feeder draws in a number of different types of birds that love to have meat and potatoes. So what they're getting out of the bird feeder, they're getting the carbohydrates and some protein from the seed. However, they also will get the added protein from the Japanese beetles. And I'll tell you, I know this is anecdotal, but my wife and I will both say the same thing. We do not have a problem with Japanese beetles. And I initiated that about 10 years ago based on working with some wildlife folks who said, you know, this might be an option, and it's been very effective.
Wow, so the party pheromones are just drawing victims to your
drawing
birds.
Drawing them in. Okay. Exactly. I love it. The birds are just waiting.
Yeah. Well, we will be back to wrap up our gardening show in just a moment. If you have questions, now is the time to call 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our gardening show, and now's the time to call with your questions. My guests are Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator, Joe Boggs, Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator, Kamisha Montgomery, and Madison Tree Care and Landscaping Vice President and CEO, John Butcher. The number to call is 513-419-7100, or you can email talk@wvxu.org. We have Mary on the phone. Thanks for calling, Mary. What's your question?
Hi. My favorite show. Thanks for taking my call. I am trying to figure out what has happened to the earthworms in my flower garden. We use no chemicals, and we put compost, well, we didn't this year, but normally we put compost into that garden bed. And I just realized, as I was digging out the masses of gout weed, that the earthworms seemed to have disappeared. And could all those gout weed roots have had anything to do with it?
That's interesting. Who wants to tackle the mystery of the earthworms?
I'm not an earthworm expert, but it has been extremely dry. And I'm just curious if they're not down a little deeper and dodging the hot surface of where you might have been removing the gout weed roots from, possibility.
Joe,
I think that's
thoughts?
I think that's a very good possibility. I was actually thinking along the same lines. Plus, there is something, though, happening, you know, with our earthworms. We're starting to see a gradual transition to some other non-natives. And notice what I just said, because our earthworms here in Southwest Ohio are actually not natives. Because they got wiped out mostly across Ohio by the glaciers. So we're starting to see some transitions into some non-natives, one of those, you know, groups called crazy worms. They don't behave at all like the earthworms that we're used to seeing. They very often will come in and really strip away the organic matter and then move on. So, you know, it's important if you do start seeing earthworms returning, to go online and just try to identify what type you have, because we have some hot spots in greater Cincinnati with these non-natives. They're not behaving like we expect.
So we don't want crazy worms?
Well, there's not much we can do about it, but yeah, that's right. You would think this group would love crazy worms, wouldn't you? I mean, given some of the conversations we had on the side.
That's right, yeah. Okay. Well, thanks, Mary. I hope that helps. We have Gail on the line. Hi, Gail. What's your question or comment?
I have a hollyhock bush, a flower. It's the beautiful black flowers on it. But it this year and last year, it's getting this kind of burnished color on the leaves, and then they turn yellow and kind of shrivel up and die after a while. Is it some kind of a bug or mold or it makes it look really ugly.
Yeah, that's no good. Nobody wants an ugly hollyhock. John, what do you think?
I'm not sure. I mean, I guess I'd have to see a picture maybe would be helpful.
Yeah.
It sounds like it could be fungally. I don't know, but it's really hard to say from that description.
Yeah. Gail, if you're near a computer, if you've got a picture, you can email it to talk@wvxu.org, and we will have them look at it.
I like John's.
Talk?
Talk, T-A-L-K, at wvxu.org.
Gotcha.
And John,
okay, thanks.
And John, I'm going to use that next time. I'm going to say, I think it's fungally. I love that adjective.
Yeah.
Actually, one thing that you do want to look at very quickly is hollyhock rust. It does cause kind of, a lot of times we miss the early stages. It, despite the name rust, it's not as rusty as what we think of with others. We've had quite a bit of it this year, and it does cause just exactly what you said. It causes the leaves to start, you know, turning into, you know, something burnished. That was a lovely term. I have to remember that. And that really describes it very well. Hollyhock rust may be something that we'll look into. And then if we get the pictures, we can see if that's true or not. If it is really fungally. I like that, John.
Well, thanks, Gail. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your call. We have Carla on the line. Hey, Carla.
Hi.
What's your question?
By the comment about the weeping cherry suffering from Japanese beetle damage.
Okay.
A number of years ago, I planted a young weeping cherry tree and had read in Rodal's organic gardening book that it helps to plant white geraniums around it because the Japanese beetles, when they ingest it, die. And sure enough, I counted nearly 50 Japanese beetle carcasses on one white geranium plant. So it works.
Wow. Thanks, Carla. That's interesting. Another way to trick the beetles, huh, Joe? In case you get tired
that
of your bird
feeder.
Yeah.
I'm watching the birds right now, though, actually going after Japanese beetles. So that's interesting.
Yeah.
They would not want the geraniums.
Yeah.
my birds would say no.
Yeah, the birds would go on strike maybe or something. Okay, we have John on the line. Hi, John. Thanks for calling. Do you have a question or comment?
Yes. I've got a bunch of spruce trees, some blue spruce and other varieties of spruce. And in a previous house, we had needle cast hit the trees pretty hard. I don't think I have needle cast now, and I've been trimming the lower limbs to try and improve airflow. But is there anything else I can do preventatively or a spray or anything?
Well, the odds are if you have a blue spruce, you probably have some level of needle cast, whether it's wiping out the tree or not, but that's really common. Needle cast is one of these diseases that I don't think you can ever fully control in every circumstance, but certainly there are preventative fungicide applications that can help slow this down and help prolong the life of the plant.
I hope that helps, John. Good luck with those spruce trees. We have an email from Joanna. Joanna emails, I followed the recommendations from someone at a garden center and sprayed my tomatoes, cucumbers, and strawberries with neem oil to prevent bugs. Soon after applying it, all my plants turned brown and wilted. It did not kill them, but I'm wondering why that happened. You have thoughts, Kamisha?
Well, what's going on in my head right now is the time that she sprayed the neem oil. Spraying it mostly, full sun can be detrimental to your plant. So I would suggest trying to apply something like that in the morning. So mostly, like I said, what I'm thinking is that it's the damage from the heat and the sun mixed with the neem oil application.
Okay. We got another listener email. The listener writes, I have 2 30-year-old red oaks and 2 40-year-old pin oaks in my yard. The red oaks have some signs of leaf wilt. In early June, an arborist looked at the trees and thought they would be okay. Since then, several dead limbs were removed. Where can I have the tree tested for leaf wilt? The arborist never really diagnosed the cause and thought perhaps it was from the lawn being treated on a windy day with herbicides. A referral to a good arborist would be appreciated. Thank you. John, do you know any good arborists?
I know at least a few. It was certainly, we would be happy to come out and look at the tree. I don't know where this person lives, but if they're on our service area, but also they can send samples to Ohio State, the Plant Pest and Diagnostic Clinic, without an arborist actually being the one to submit the sample. So that's something they could do on their own as well if they were a go-getter.
Okay. Okay. Let's see. We also have an email from Liz. There is a large hillside embankment here in Middletown that is covered with invasive trees of heaven. Trees of heaven are known to attract the invasive spotted lanternfly species. I want to report this potential problem, but to whom do I report this? Joe, do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, we really, I mean, that's not, there really isn't anyone to report that to, unfortunately. Tree of Heaven is on the Ohio invasive plants list, but that's mostly to keep from people, you know, planting it, selling it and planting it. In terms of reporting a location, there really isn't a regulatory agency to do that. On the other hand, that also serves a purpose. To my knowledge, I do not believe that spotted lanternfly has been detected in the Middletown area. I actually live not far from there. And so you're absolutely right. Tree of Heaven, you know, is their number one host. They'll also go to maples and a lot of other plants, including we're seeing a lot of them on roses this year, which is a bit of a surprise. But they can be sentinel trees, is what I'm saying. So there's no one to report it to, but I would urge that you might want to talk to the folks managing the parks and managing landscaping in Middletown, just to say, you know, that's a pretty good area to be monitoring for spotted lanternfly, because it's most likely it will show up on those trees before you see it anywhere else. And that is something to report to the Ohio Department of Agriculture if you do see spotted lanternfly outside of where it's been previously reported. So that's actually kind of a, I hate to say, a good news. These sentinel trees helps us to define where that non-native invasive has made its way into.
Okay. We did get an email from Kate. Kate was referring to our earlier conversation about chiggers. Kate writes, my chigger solution, I wear a jumpsuit with knee-high boots. Chiggers jump onto your ankles and climb up. The boots and jumpsuit block their access. Getting suited up is annoying, but it works. It sounds really hot this time of year.
Well, you know, that is true, though. And I was going to say that because we hate to see people having to do that to go in their backyards. But one thing I was going to ask earlier was, I forget the fellow's name. I think his name was Jonathan, but I might be wrong. But, you know, was he going anywhere else and perhaps encountering chiggers? Sometimes we do have that happen. You go to a park and it doesn't even look like a chiggery place. There's a new one, John, right? You know,
like
a chiggery
spot. I like it.
Yeah. And, but then you do get them. But we do have deterrents also. And I just would urge, because mostly of ticks, I know you've had previous shows about, you know, not coming in contact with ticks. I just think we ought to make sure that when we are out and about, that we are aware it's not just chiggers, and some of the deterrents, combination of clothing and then some of the repellents that are very effective. I just urge now that people are paying very close attention to that.
Well, speaking of deterrents, summer's the prime time for pests. Kamisha, what are your favorite ways of dealing with pests and keeping them out of your garden, that ways that don't necessarily involve pesticides?
Oh, there's so many different ways that you can deter pest pressure from your gardens. First one, companion planting. Planting something like marigolds, garlic, you know, just using those to deter different pests, or just inviting, like Joe had talked about with the water or with the bird feeder, inviting other
critters.
Yeah, critters. Inviting other critters or insects, beneficials to the garden that help take care of those problems and helping out with the local ecosystem within your garden. But other things besides, you know, pesticides, but you can also handpick. You know, if you see those Japanese beetles, if you see those tomato hornworms, mm-hmm. go ahead and handpick those. If you have chickens, they're perfect. Other things that you can use is like BT, neem oil, which was mentioned earlier. So there's some different more on the organic side of pest control measures that you can use. And also you can incorporate some diatomaceous earth other than, you know, just a pesticide or something like that application.
Joe, I know wasps can help by feasting on some of the unwanted pests. Should we be making our homes more wasp-friendly?
Absolutely. You know, this is one that's so easy to do. There is very good scientific data connecting having a wide range of flowering plants, because many of the insects that come in, all the wasps, for example, also feed on pollen and nectar. They're actually very good pollinators, but they are predators on caterpillars. So if you have in your landscaping a diverse collection of flowering plants, you can seriously reduce the pests that are in that garden. And if you want to go to a place to see us firsthand, go to the Cincinnati Botanical Garden and Zoo, and you will and you will see. I mean, you really won't see many pests there. And so that's where this connection has been made. But a final thing too, a squash vine borer, for example. You know, earlier the question was, okay, what can you do to extend the garden? You can still plant squash right now, Kamisha, right?
I mean, definitely.
And if you do, you're going to miss the adult egg laying later on. And so you might lose squash early and then plant another round right now, and you'll have squash later in the season. So sometimes it's a matter of just planting a little later, you know, extending your garden, and you will dodge some of these pests.
Yeah, just knowing the life cycle of some of those pests will definitely help you out.
Kamisha, do you ever have to use pesticides? And if so, are there pesticides that are more organic in nature than others?
I don't recommend it. I think the most radical that I would go in that direction is 7, which I have seen it being used in several different gardens. But I try to steer away from it and just gear my gardeners more towards ways to prevent pests and inviting more beneficials to help out in the garden.
Okay. Well, I've been talking with Ohio State University Assistant Professor of Entomology and Hamilton County Extension Educator Joe Boggs, Civic Garden Center Urban Agriculture Coordinator Kamisha Montgomery, and Madison Tree Care and Landscaping Vice President and CEO John Butcher, who does not lie to his clients. Thank you all so much for your time today. I was trying to make up for that. You don't think that worked?
That was great.
Okay.
Okay. What an ending. Oh, my goodness.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.